All right. Well, hey, I want to thank Sean for joining us with this call, and then all of you that have jumped on as well as we talked to Sean Lovejoy about the art of the start. And there's some science to it, but what I've learned over the years is it really takes an artist to start well. So Sean actually started Mountain Light Church. He was a church planter there in Cumming, Georgia. That was a big thing that he started. He also started churchplanters.com in the midst of running this mega church, and then also has just started CourageToLead.com. So, Sean, thanks for joining us on the call.
Great to be with you on the call, buddy. I appreciate all you do for the kingdom.
Oh, man, and likewise with you. But I've got a couple of questions that have come in, and I know some more might come in to that phone number, 760-505-4937. But I got to ask you, Sean, what in the world compelled you to start Mountain Lake Church?
Well, you know, you get this fire in your bones. It's a supernatural calling from God. I used to ask people all of the time, how did you know God called you? And they would always respond to me by saying, well, you just know. And that frustrated the heck out of me. But over the years, I've come to understand and embrace, you know, what God's call about. To me, you know that you're called when you can't do anything else. And I just came to the point in my life where I could not do anything else other than start Mountain Lake Church. To me, that's when you know that you know that you know that you're called. And the same thing just happened again 17 years later. I came to the point and place in my life where I felt like I could do no other thing other than, you know, turn my church over to my successor and start a new thing. You know, it's a supernatural fire in your bones that God puts there.
Okay, can you describe that maybe a little bit more, put some handles on that that would be... Well, was it circumstances that helped you know that you know? Was it did God talk to you like he talked to Moses? Did a friend come to you? I mean, tell us all on the call more about how you learned and how you knew that you knew.
I think God wires your – I mean, I think obviously experiences, you know, play a role in it. I was a college and career – remember college and career Sunday school classes? I was a college and career Sunday school class teacher, and we started this class with four people, and they were all college dropouts in a rural Alabama town. And we started reaching crack addicts and prostitutes and lesbians and everything else, and people – broken people from – you know, every walk of life, and they started giving their lives to Jesus and being set free from all kinds of vices. And, man, it was during that season of life, like, God just ruined me when you saw what true life change looks like. And we rocked this little Baptist church I was part of at the time. And it was during those days I was just like, gosh, what if you did this with all of your life? Like, what if you had a whole church full of broken people like this? And so through my experiences, you know, God just planted a seed for it. And then I think God uses your passions, just your natural passions. I can't explain it. People will judge me when I say this, but I call me carnal if you want to, but I've just always enjoyed hanging out with lost people. I love lost people, maybe more so than most Christians. I don't know.
Don't send me a Christmas card. Darn it.
That's right. I love being with broken people, you know, and then, you know, opportunity. That's the other one that Guy Kawasaki talks about in Art of the Start, the book. I mean, he talks about what are the opportunities, and there are just so many opportunities out there to reach people that no other church is reaching. And all of those just combined to help me recognize, along with my giftedness, you know, I was made for this. I was made for this, and I didn't know if I'd be successful, by the way. I think a lot of guys get paralyzed by fear. It may be the number one obstacle to starting what God's placed upon your heart, but I didn't know I'd be successful, but I would be failing not to try. I knew that.
Okay, well, obviously God used you and your team to build quite a work there at Mountain Lake, and so help us understand – if you would, like when you face a fear, whether it's a big giant bear kind of a fear or it's a little kind of gnawing inside, how do you personally deal with that? You know, gosh, I'm just not sure, or there might be a little bit of, maybe fear is too strong a word, but even anxiety about what's next. How do you deal with that so that you can move forward to start?
Well, I would just say that, you know, I didn't grow up in it with any kind of charismatic background, and so I kind of refuted this whole idea of seeing demons jumping out from behind every bush. But I think, you know, I negated the reality of spiritual warfare so much that I didn't recognize it in early years. And I've come to embrace and recognize that fear only comes from one place. I mean, God has not given us a spirit of fear, right? But of power and love. So if we're feeling fear, that's not from God. I've come to recognize that as the evil one attacking me, trying to keep me from becoming what he wants me to be and doing, you know, what he wants me to do. So when I feel fear, I know it's from him, and I have to react, you know, against him in my own spirit, in my own life. That has helped me. I mean, that may seem over-spiritualized and oversimplified, Chris, but that has helped me. And I told a friend the other day, I'm back in that same place 17 years later. I mean, Satan constantly tells me I don't have what it takes and I can't do what God's placed upon my heart. I hear that evil voice, you know, and then I hear this still small voice that God's not giving you a spirit of fear, you know, but power, love, and self-discipline. You can do all things through Christ who strengthens you. So it's spiritual. It's very, very spiritual for me in refuting those fears.
Okay, for those of you that have just joined the call, hey, we want to welcome you to the call with Sean Lovejoy. We're talking about the art of the start, and there's all kinds of things that we start in ministry. Sean has started a church, Mountain Lake Church. He was the church planter. As that was going on, he started CampusPastors.com, a ministry to help, or I said CampusPastors.com, sorry, ChurchPlanters.com, to help church planters, and then, of course, has just launched now and started Courage to Lead. So, Sean, those are big things that you've started, but I know that you've started smaller things along the way, either directly or indirectly. Talk to us about starting something, you know, smaller, maybe a division of ministry or something within a church that's already existing that doesn't take maybe as much a quote-unquote gumption, but that's a little bit smaller, maybe a piece of a church.
Well, I think so many people think they can't start new things because they can't start big. You know, most churches never start a new church, never been a part of starting a new church. So we just decided, you know, we were not going to wait until we had enough money and enough resources to be part of starting new churches. You know, so we started small. I remember when we took up a special offering in church and we set aside $6,000 of that. And we bought lights and all the production lights. This was in 2001. You know, we're barely a fledgling 18-month-old church, and we just decided we wouldn't let resources be a barrier. And we purchased all the lights for a new church that was going to be starting about 20 minutes away. And we helped them launch, and we went door to door and put the door hangers on their doors for them. So it didn't cost us anything. And this new church launched with about 400 people, which was larger than we were. You know, so I think one of the reasons people don't start things is they wait until everything's lined up. Perfectionism can be an obstacle to starting. Wait till you have all the people in place, all the resources in place. And I had a mentor several years ago tell me, chief of staff out at Saddleback Church, David Sean, you know him. He said, Sean, you don't solve all the problems and then go make the decision. If you walk by faith, you make the decision and you solve the problems in that order. And that has helped me probably, you know, as much as anything or anybody ever told me as far as getting ready to start something. Just start it. Just start it. And it's not going to be perfect. Many are the plans in a man's heart. The Lord determines his steps. So just start with what you have now. And God says if we'll be faithful in the little, you know, he'll give us more. So don't let perfectionism hold you back. And there's been so many things like that over time. We've like, well, we don't really have all the means to do this like we want to do it, but we're going to start small, and you know, we're going to grow it big. And of course, over the years, you know, we had to start every program, every ministry from scratch, and we rarely had it all figured out. We're pioneering new ways to do ministry. I mean, you know this. It was 1999. We were learning from you guys and implementing message-based curriculum in the Southeast. I didn't know of another church who had attempted that. But we pioneered our way forward. We fought past the fear and the perfectionism and realized that we'd never done it before. And we started small. We started simple with what we had. We couldn't do it like North Coast was doing it. That was probably averaging 5,000 people in attendance at the time. But we started with what we have, and we worked into, you know, what there is today, 17 years later.
Okay, I want to hang on that for just a second, Sean, and say some of us have started with what we have. We've got a great vision for the future. We just absolutely know it's going to work out. And so we start, we get our friends and our family and maybe even other people involved in it, and it falls flat. In other words, it fails. Now what are you going to tell me? I just did what you said. I started with what I had. I thought everything was going to work out. And, I mean, a good cause and everything, and failure was on the other end of that line. Now,
well, you know,
help me understand that one.
Sure. You'll hear me quote a lot of people because I've never had an original thought, Chris. You probably know that by now because we've known each other a long time. But everything I know I've learned from somebody else. But I heard John Maxwell say years ago, like, the first class they ought to teach in college is failure 101, like how to fail. Because failure is a normal, natural, and necessary part of life. I mean, Jacob, who later became known as Israel, I mean, the whole debacle started with a failure. Joseph and his dreams started with a failure. Over and over and over, you know, people have in their mind's eye what they think it's going to look like. And I just quoted for you, many are the plans in a man's heart, but the Lord determines his steps. So failure is part of the process. It's not the end of the process. It's part of the process. So as we fail, we learn, and we always fail forward. I've already failed in the new ministry I'm launching now in some things. But you fail your way forward. Failure does not mean, you know, it's time to quit whatsoever. It just means the Lord is guiding you. The Lord is pruning you. The Lord is challenging you and fashioning you into the person he wants you to be. In Jacob's case, he ended up with a limp after it. But frankly, God used him greater after the limp than before the limp. And I think it's okay to lead with a limp and have a few failures in your arsenal. But most guys are not healthy enough emotionally, relationally, spiritually to kind of take that on and be willing to fight through the failure to be successful. The successful people aren't ones who fail. They're ones who fail and keep failing. That's successful. That's success.
Okay, Sean, I know you do a lot of coaching in your various ministries, and so let's pretend for just a moment that I'm one of your coachees, and I confess to you, Sean, I'm just afraid of failing. What exercise would you give me to utilize, or what would you tell me to help me overcome my fear of failure?
Well, a lot of guys feel like, you know, to do things successful or to start something or to make a move or make a change, that you've got to kind of go big or go home. But I tell guys all the time, hey, you know, pilot things. I mean, take a simple step toward all of that. I mean, if people have been following my ministry closely, they think one day I'm just out on the river with God and I've been pastoring this church for 16 years and I decide to walk away and start consulting and coaching with pastors. No, that's not the case at all. I started attempting to coach pastors almost 13 years ago. You know, we started very, very small, very, very simply. And then you look to see if God uses that gift or blesses that, or if not, if it's not recognized, if it's not utilized, then you move a different direction. So I would say to guys, if you're afraid of failure, one of the ways to mitigate that failure is to start small. Don't start big. It's easy to dream big, but it's another thing to start small. Start simple. You know, if you feel like God may call you to plant a church one day, start a small group. Start a small group. If you can't get anybody to join your small group, I can almost promise you God didn't call you to start a church.
Yeah, okay, sure. Man, that is real wisdom. That is great. I have want to shift to now, instead of talking about a whole brand new thing, let's talk about a pre-existing ministry. Maybe the church has been around for 15, 20, 30, could be 100 years. Who knows? But the church is already going. But we want to start a new thing within a pre-existing church or a pre-existing structure. Could you kind of identify for us, hey, what's a pitfall or two to watch out for, and then what is a kind of a rocket to ride in that situation?
Well, first of all, I tell guys all the time, be careful because you could get fired.
Oh, thanks for the encouragement there, bro.
Yeah,
come on,
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
If you did, but be careful. Even if you, okay?
A lot of young leaders need to hear this, though. If you do the right thing the wrong way, you still get the same results. Let me say that again. If you do the right thing the wrong way, you still get the same results. And too many times, you know, I see young leaders run off to a conference and they come back home on Sunday, and I think their churches do not look forward to them coming home from conferences because they stand up on the platform and they say, I've been to a conference, God spoke to me, and we're changing everything. And that seems humorous to us, but I know pastors who've almost used that rhetoric word for word, and most of them are no longer on staff at their churches. So I know what I'm talking about. I mean, I'm being tongue-in-cheek, but I know this has actually happened. So you have to the goal of change is to take people with you. John Maxwell said, he that thinketh he leadeth and no one followeth is only taking a walk. So the goal is to take people with you. So about 7 years into our church, we were way on the attractional missional pendulum at Mountain Lake Church. We were way, way out on the attractional pendulum. And I was convicted by that. I did some personal repenting of that because I didn't want our church to only use the worship service as the front door of the church. I wanted our people to be on mission. I wanted to open our small groups to the community. I wanted those small groups putting feet to their faith more. So we just recognized a need to change our church's culture and move on that pendulum between attractional and missional down the scale. And so we began, you know, working behind the scenes. And I'll just rattle these off. I've actually taught on these, but I had to be committed to modeling the way of the new change. If you want to start something, you got to live it. You got to be the culture you want to build. If you're trying to move from Sunday school to small groups, well, you got to be in a small group. You got to lead one. You got to do all that. Secondly, I think it's always important to seek some outside help, to kind of be your navigator, to help you implement new change and do it wisely, because when you change things, you only get so many change chips. And if you're not effective at the change and you end up with the same results and the same fruit at the end of the change, then you lose all your change chips. So you got to get change right. It better add fruit to the mission when you do it. Thirdly, we didn't move too quickly. You know, you got to be patient with people. And when we were trying to move our church on that pendulum, we were talking about a 2 to 3 year journey. 2 to 3 year journey. Then we spent a great deal of time discipling our leaders. I started with our staff. I spent 6 months with them, helping them understand what we were trying to do. Had lots of meetings with key leaders before the meeting, you know, where we went public with all this stuff. We took 130 of our key lay people off on a leadership retreat, where I sat down and shared my heart with them. Then after we'd done all of that over about a year's period of time, that's when we went public to the church, you know, about the change. And then we kept talking about it every week because their tendency is to think the pastor will shut up about this. He'll move on to something else when he comes back from a conference next year. But that when you're trying to, you know, implement change and start something new, you got to stick to it. You got to stick to it. You got to let people know you're not going to stop talking about this. This is a new culture. This is a new thing. This is where we're going. This is part of the vision, and we want everybody to go with us.
Well, that sounds a lot like something that I've learned from you over the years, and I've heard it from you probably 100 times. Chris, you have to be mean about the vision.
You do, and I'm not when I talk about being mean about the vision, I'm not talking about me being a mean leader. I mean, I know too many of those.
Yeah,
I know
right.
Some mean preachers, don't you? But I'm talking about being mean about the vision. The word mean can also be used to convey intent. What I meant to say was, or I didn't mean that. Being mean about the vision is about being intentional about what we do and why we do it. Because if we don't know why we're doing what we're doing, when it's challenged, when we meet an obstacle, when we feel like we failed, when it looks differently than what we thought, when we're not the next Larry Osborne, Andy Stanley, or Craig Groeschel like we thought we were going to be, when we forget why we're doing, the what becomes less sexy, and we'll lose our passion and we'll give up on it. If we don't know that we know that we know that we're doing what we're doing because God's like placed this vision in our heart, and we got that, that allows us to stay relentless in it.
Well, as I heard you talk about this process of change, and you picked out one that you, you took, it actually took a couple of years of preparatory work. Man, you can't do a couple years of preparatory work, it doesn't seem to me, unless you are intentional about the vision. And so how can we tell, like, when it's time to take the next step and if we're going either too slow or too fast?
Well, I think, you know, one, as leaders, we don't listen enough. I mean, so many of us,
you know,
we can't.
Can you repeat that?
Leaders don't listen enough.
Okay.
We don't listen enough. We just have our idea, and God told us. I mean, who can argue with us? Because God told us, right? And so it's like, come hell or high water, we're doing what I think God told me to do. And I mean, I think that's pride and arrogance, honestly. I think leaders need to listen more to the key leaders around us. And I'm not talking about a show of hands and vote in our churches. I know you guys don't do that every Sunday. We never did either. But I did have some leaders around me that I could talk these things through with and listen to them and get their feedback. And honestly, I didn't listen to everybody in our church. And I hope all of Mountain Lake is not listening, but I didn't listen to everybody in our church. But I would listen to one category of people. There's three requirements for people I would listen to. One, they had to love God. One, they had to love the vision. And three, I had to know that they loved me. And I would put those people in leadership in our church. Because okay. I knew, even if they disagreed with me, if they were speaking into something, giving me feedback, I know they had the churches, the vision, and even my best interest in mind. And I can't tell you how many times, we never, in 17 years, Chris, we never had a train wreck. We never had a train wreck. I'm so proud of that. But it wasn't because I'm a genius. It was because we allowed the body of Christ and leaders to speak into the process. And there were many meetings I sat in with our ministry team, our staff, our pastors, our advisory team, our finance team, our small group leaders. And I would begin saying, thank God, here's what I sense God could be leading us to do. But I want to hear from you. I want to get your feedback. What does the Lord say to you when I say that out loud in a smaller circle of people? And I can't tell you how many times one of those leaders would speak up and say, Sean, we love you, and we probably could be for that, but whatever you do, don't say it like you just said it. And they
okay.
And they
yeah.
they saved my rear end as a young leader. And frankly, they saved our church some pain. And so I would just say, as leaders, whatever you do, don't kind of react against, you know, these congregational dominated, you know, some, kind of some bad exposures and experiences people have had with bad elder boards and deacon boards, and throw the baby out with the bathwater. And be willing to surround yourself with some people that you trust and you can listen to. Because when you get ready to start new things, you're going to start more effectively, you're going to have more support, more influence, and more people have your back when the change is challenged. Because they can say, no, I've spent weeks, I've spent months hearing from this leader, I've heard his heart, I'm with him, I spoke into the process, I believe this is what God's called us to do. Man, that's such a better way to affect change in a culture.
Well, gang, we're talking with Sean Lovejoy about the art of the start. Starting something new, either brand new or starting something new within a pre-existing ministry. And I feel like I'm at the best conference ever on starting stuff. I've taken two pages of notes so far, and I haven't even talked to you yet about when the Mountain Lake Church kind of went into the multi-site genre, which that's starting something new. And can you tell us the why behind that?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, again, just based upon our experience and, you know, our passions to be a multiplying church. I mean, we didn't just decide one day, oh, hey, lots of churches are growing by launching campuses. Let's launch a campus. You know, that's the wrong reason to start a campus. It was more out of who we were and being a multiplying church, starting churches. In fact, we decided when we were going to go multi-campus, we said, hey, I don't think anybody's really doing it quite like we feel called to do it, because I mean, church planting is our DNA, and I don't feel like preaching is even my best spiritual gift, so we're not going to go video venue with these new campuses. We're going to make them hybrids between a church plant and a new campus, and we're going to start it with a campus pastor who also does the live teaching at those campuses. So we kind of pioneered our way forward. Nobody was talking about that. You know, 7, 8, 10 years ago, we began to have the discussions about what it would look like to multiply our DNA with a live communicator on another site. We were scared to death. But I began to realize we better get some people from the outside who know what's going on out there in terms of church planting and multi-site, and they're not hung up on one way to do things. And let's bring them in and let them spend some time with us. And so we did. I mean, we brought in 3 or 4, you know, different coaches and consultants and said, hey, here's who we are. Here's what we feel like we're good at. Here's what we don't feel like we're good at. Here's what we feel like God could be calling us to do. Are we crazy for thinking this? And allowing some wise mentors, coaches, consultants to speak into what we were doing. So by the time I was, you know, went public with the church in terms of what we were doing, I was able to tell them with credibility, hey, we didn't just come up with some idea, you know, in a van down by the river on a retreat, you know, me and 2 other pastors and come back with it. Like, we have sought counsel around the nation from godly men who have done this and who have coached this and consulted this. Man, we just had a much better plan. We had a much better plan down the road.
Yeah, good. Okay. Hey, for those of you that are on the call, if you have a question that you want Sean to address specifically, you can send it to me at 760-505-4937. 760-505-4937. And so, Sean, we're getting a couple of questions, and I have a few here about frustration of people. It could be staff, could be congregation, could be even people on the board. How do we move forward so that we don't frustrate people in the midst of change? My first question is that even possible?
Yeah, Bill Hybels said years ago, the only way you can make everyone happy is have no vision.
Okay, all right.
I mean, if you have, without a vision, people perish. Without a vision, people cast off restraint. Without a vision, there's no clarity. There is no direction. But the moment you have a direction, not everyone's going to be for you, and not everyone's going to be for it, a.k.a. our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. I mean, he never for 1 minute had 100% support. If he couldn't get it,
okay. Well, let's attack the question this way. How about what have you learned in your decades of ministry that when you're moving forward with something new, that we mitigate the frustration the best way that we can? What are some hot tips on helping people either deal with their frustration or me as a leader putting up with their frustration that's directed at me?
Right. Well, first of all, there's 2 types of, you know, responses when you're enacting change. There's criticism and there are critiques. And it's important to try to differentiate between the two. You know, a critique comes from somebody who loves you, loves the vision, and loves the church. You know, a criticism is from a person that Jesus couldn't make happy. And, you know, those are the people to which Nehemiah said, I don't even have time to come down from the wall. I mean, that's being mean about the vision. I do not have time. We're doing a great work here. I don't have time for this. But I usually say to leaders, when it comes to critiques and criticisms, make sure we do respond, just don't react. Make sure we do respond, just don't react. I've learned that so many of those people who get agitated or frustrated with change, sometimes they don't mean it. I mean, they're not mean people. They're not evil people. They just don't know what they don't know, and they're down on what they're not up on. And so part of this is just discipleship. Like, they don't understand how to reach people. They don't really understand that the church is losing ground. They really don't understand what it takes to make disciples. And so you need to not see people that are frustrated or agitated with change as the enemy, but be willing to sit down, respond to their questions, and help explain, you know, what's going on. I'll never forget Reggie Joyner, who was at North Point and then started the whole orange phenomenon. He said years ago a guy challenged him in an eating establishment about why North Point didn't offer Sunday school and why they were so bent on small groups. And he said, in that moment, I could decide, blow him off and treat him as the enemy, or use this as a discipling opportunity. And so he just sat down for about 5 minutes. He said, you mind if I pull up a seat? And for 5 minutes, he just began to rattle off, in love, a bullet point list of why he thought, you know, small groups were a better discipleship method, and shared his heart with him. And within 5 to 7 minutes, the man said, well, you know what? I've never thought of it that way. And we might join one of those. Rather than treat him as this evil, you know, person that's trying to derail us and against us, use it as a discipling, you know, opportunity. Now, the criticisms, the people who just don't, you know, you can't please and you can't get on board, you can't all that, that is the, I don't have time. You know, there are those situations where you just got to keep plowing forward despite, you know, some gravity against you.
Okay, how have you effectively dealt with those people so that they don't eat up your time or they don't hijack your vision?
Well, you got to have thick skin, and two, you've got to balance grace with truth. Both are important. I mean, pastors sometimes are the biggest liars. We are. Because we will pat people on the back, and we will smile, and we will tell them they're the best, and then we'll go home and complain, you know, to our spouse about them, rather than just being honest with them and confronting and responding to them. And so for years at Mount Lake, the reason we were so just as unified the day I left as when we met in my living room, and I can say that with every bit of integrity, was not because we never had conflicts or complaints or all of that. It's because we responded to every single one of those. And when I knew somebody was, you know, out to get me or upset at me, I didn't just bury my head in the sand and passively aggressively talk about them to my wife. I'd schedule a coffee with them, and I'd go and I'd sit down and I'd talk with them and just say, hey, brother, I love you. I got this. You may not have meant it this way, but when I got your email, it kind of hit me wrong, even hurt my feelings a little bit. And we're brothers, and I'd love to talk through it. And at the end of that conversation, though, let them know this is where we're going. This is what we're, you know, this is the change we feel called to make. Or this is, I would love for you to go. But if you can't, then maybe we don't need to go to church together. And give permission for people to leave. Give permission for people to go. Don't try to hold on to everybody. Sometimes I think churches grow by what I call strategic regression. And it hurts when somebody leaves, but our goal is not to hang on to everybody. It's not. And to try to please everybody. We can't get caught up in that trap, because that's a slippery slope too.
Okay. Let's take about, I don't know how long it'll take, a few minutes. And give me, if you would, Sean, the top two or three lessons that you've learned as a leader when it comes to starting something new. Not the list of 19 things. What are two things that, man, I, or anybody that you're coaching needs to know about starting something new?
Well, I think the top two mistakes that people make when launching something is they launch too soon and they launch too underfunded. In other words, they haven't done all their homework. They don't have everything together. You know, they've predetermined some timeline in their mind to launch this versus a set of milestones that need to be accomplished before an effective launch. And I really think milestones are more important than timelines. For example, if you don't have a worship leader, you don't have a worship. You don't have a worship service. If you don't have small group leaders, you don't have small groups, so you don't have a discipleship plan. So I get called all the time by church planters who are 6 months, 12 months. The church is 6 months, 12 months old, and they're like, when should we start small groups? And we don't understand why we're baptizing all these people and the church is not growing. It's because they launch without having key systems and leaders in place. And guys will launch too soon because they feel like they're losing time by, you know, waiting. But the truth is, by waiting and dotting your I's and crossing your T's and doing your homework and getting key systems in place on the front end, you can actually hurdle past all those painful early months and maybe years and hurdle over those and become a faster-growing church, a larger church from day one because the key systems are in place. So they launch too soon. Secondly, you know, leaders launch too underfunded. It's like building a house. I mean, it always takes longer than you think, and it always costs more than you think. And I see too many young leaders say, man, God's given me a vision, and we're going to do this. And I told my wife, you know, pack the U-Haul, and so we're going. And 18 months later, because they didn't raise all the resources that they needed on the front end to be successful, I mean, they're underfunded. The inside support's not matching the outside support. The outside support's running out. They're disillusioned, frustrated. Their wife's mad at God, mad at them for moving their kids and pulling them out of school and putting them in a new place, all because they didn't have the proper funds, you know, on the front end. In 1999, it was a huge leap of faith for me to leave a mega church here in Birmingham and go to Atlanta and plant a church. But frankly, I had $250,000 in the bank. And worst case scenario, I had my salary paid for 2 years. And worst case scenario, I had to go get a job in 2 years. And so I was able to focus those 2 years on building the ministry versus running around begging everybody for money outside the organization. And I was able to focus on building an effective ministry, you know, during that time. So I would just say to guys, if you're starting something, it costs a lot more than you think. Do your homework. Make sure you factor everything in and do as much as you can on the front end to see that thing funded effectively, you know, before you start. You know, 17 years later, I've done that again. I mean, Chris, a lot of people thought I was crazy from walking away from this mega church and national ministry to do what I had. But I had about 18 months of my salary, you know, already guaranteed through my the greatest capital I've had is my relationships. So I was able to show my wife on paper, men, I would counsel you in this area strongly. I was able to show my wife on an Excel spreadsheet that our financial needs for the next 18 months were taken care of. After that, we might have to go both work at McDonald's and Home Depot, you know, but we knew we had 18 months, you know, taken care of to get the ministry, you know, off the ground. And of course, you know, God's blessed that.
Yeah, good. Hey, I have a question shifting to the other side of that. You've started something new. You put your blood, your sweat, your tears, your time, your talent, your treasure, everything, you know, into it. And now you're on the backside of it. God is blessed. You're walking in the Spirit with Him. And things have just gone great. Tell me about that and tell me what's been the best part for you of starting something new and then seeing that be successful?
Well, you know, I said this in my book several years ago, The Measure of Our Success. I wrote that to pastors. I just said, if you're not happy with 10 people and content with 10 people, you won't be content when 100 people, 1,000 people, or 10,000 people come. I mean, basing, you know, your success upon the future numbers is one of the emptiest pursuits in humanity. Read the book of Ecclesiastes. It's a book of lament.
Yeah, okay.
of lament. I mean, he got it all. He conquered it all. And the word he used at the end of it all was meaningless. And so I just say to guys, how are you going to measure success at the end of the day? For me, okay? For me. One of the biggest lies I ever believed was that, hey, when we get to here, it will be so much easier. When we hire this person, it's going to be easier. When we get in the building, it's going to be easier. I remember trying to cross the threshold of $1 million budget. Man, when we get up to $1 million, do you remember those days, Chris, at Northgate?
I do.
Man, when we get to a million-dollar budget, man, we'll have so much, and we'll be able to do so. Then we'll be happy. And that day just never comes because you get there, and the needs always outpace the resources. So I just kind of, again, failed my way forward in learning all that, so a lot of that the hard way, especially as a man, to embrace the fact that at the end of the day, I probably could have grown that lake faster and bigger, but I decided I was not going to compromise who I was, and I wasn't going to compromise my relationship with God, my relationship with the family, and I wasn't going to compromise the vision. And on the day that I stood up and told Mountain Lake Church that I felt like God was calling me to transition the church to my successor, I told them, here are the three things that I'm most proud of. My wife likes me. My wife likes me. Not just loves me, but she likes me. She respects me as a human being. My kids love the church. And not just our church, but the church. Because the positive environment and culture we've been able to have here. And three, we've stayed true to the vision. And guess what? That just never ends. So if you're leading an organization, you can get up every day and work about that. And regardless of where you are, it allows you to enjoy the journey. Because at the end of each day, I can evaluate my day by those three criteria. Does my wife like me today? Do my kids still love the church today? And did I stay true to the vision today? If I did that, I've been successful today. Check mark. Not mark that off the list. I can lay down at night and sleep in peace because I've been faithful. And faithfulness comes before fruitfulness. I really believe that.
Fantastic. Say, will you talk to us just real quick about you've got this book that's coming out in April. And I'd love to hear just a little bit about that. And you alluded to it. But tell me about the book that's coming out in April, and why did you start writing it?
Well, you know, in 2003, we started this conference for pastors really as an inspiration, an encouraging point for church planters and pastors called Velocity. And in 2003 or 2004, I spoke at Velocity that year, and Ed Stetzer was also one of our speakers that year. And I spoke that year on being mean about the vision, preserving and protecting the vision over time, and how it's easy to have a vision, but it's another thing to see it through. It's another thing to be willing to die for it. It's another thing to defend it and protect it and stay true to it and not quit on it when it gets hard and all of that. And Ed Stetzer heard me teach at the conference that day, and we began coaching pastors around that issue. But Ed told me that day, he said, Sean, you have got to write about that. Everybody talks about developing a vision statement. And everybody talks about how to find, you know, the vision, but very few talk about how to protect it and preserve it over time in a church or in any other organization, because there are a lot of transferable principles even into what I'm doing now in being mean about the vision. So we started coaching pastors along about being mean about the vision, how to stay true, giving them permission to be what God's called them to be and do what God's called them to do. So we've been coaching pastors, you know, around the vision piece and how to consistently communicate it, how to get clearer about it, how to rekindle it when it's died in you, how to keep it from being hijacked if the vision has been derailed, how to reclaim it, all of that. And finally, I just didn't feel permission to write about it until now, until the year I'm leaving my church after having been there 17 years. You know, and I'm real proud of what, you know, God built there. And because it was built around the vision and not around a man, like I'm proud of a lot God did there in 17 years, Chris. But you and I haven't even talked about this. But since I left, Mountain Lake Church has lost zero attendance and zero giving in the first 6 months since I left.
Yeah.
And that just doesn't happen. But I'm proud of that.
Well, you should be proud
because
of that, Sean.
I've
learned over
church,
the years that – oh, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say we built a church around the vision, not a man, and we preserved it, you know, to the day I left and handed it off, you know, in a healthy fashion to a new leader who can continue to steward it forward. I'm proud of that. So that book is all about that.
Okay. Well, I've learned that vision is a lot like marriage. It's easy to get married. The tough part is staying married. And, man, it's easy to come up with a vision, but staying relentless, staying mean about the vision, that's where the rubber meets the road. And so for you pastors and church leaders that are on this call, man, I want to thank you for joining us on this Sticky Teams conference call. And we've got another one coming up next month, and so we're going to get you the information on that, shoot it through email. But, Sean, thank you so much for sharing openly and honestly with those of us on the call just about your journey, about what you've learned through the highs and the lows of that. And we appreciate your investment in us and your investment in the kingdom. And I want to give you a moment for a last parting piece of wisdom. So let us, what's God put on your heart to make sure that we know before we hang up?
Well, I would just say to these guys who are thinking about starting or maybe who have just started something, I mean, it's really the way I close the book, Be Mean About the Vision. I mean, if God gives you a vision, it's a sacred trust, which really means it's a stewardship. Like the word vision means revelation. So God speaks to us, and he moves in our hearts to start something. And that vision is a stewardship. It's a sacred trust to be stewarded, and we are going to be held accountable for it. So if we start it, and then because it gets hard, or because we feel like we failed, and we quit, and we give up on the vision before we know that we know that we know that God has released us from that, then literally we failed to steward the vision that God gave us. We've missed the mark. So it's literally sinful to give up on a dream that God gives us. So I would just say to leaders, if you're thinking about doing it, you got to do it. I mean, if you feel like God's calling you to do this, it doesn't matter if you don't think anybody will go with you. It doesn't matter if you don't think you have the resources. It doesn't matter if you think you're capable of doing it. You got to go for it. You got, if God's calling you. Secondly, if he did call you, when you say I do, you did. And you got to see it through. You got to finish what you started. You cannot give up on it because you're tired or discouraged or disappointed or frustrated or angry. We got to repent of all that stuff, get back on our horse, dust ourselves off, and go forward. And I believe God almost honors that decision versus sitting on the fence. I don't know if we're going to stick it out, you know, whatever. There's a power in saying, God, you called me to this. I'm going to be obedient. Whatever it looks like, if I have to be a weeping prophet like Jeremiah, I'm going to be true to stick this out. And it's almost like God blesses that and honors that heart. So that would be, you know, my parting words of wisdom for guys today. Just don't give up on the vision.
Beautiful. And then, Sean, there's probably somebody on the call that's going to want to get a hold of you, maybe ask you a specific question or two or whatever. How can we get a hold of you?
Just email me. I'm like you, like your pastor. I'm very approachable and accessible. Sean@couragetolead.com. S-H-A-W-N. It comes right to me. I read every one of my emails.
Okay. So Sean, S-H-A-W-N, at couragetolead.com.
That's correct.
Is that right? Okay, man.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks again. And for all of you that joined us on the call, man, we want to thank you. We want to be a resource to you, and we want to bring the best available. And, man, Sean, you knocked it out of the park. Thank you so much. I've got to go review my notes and make sure I tweak a couple of things on my end so that I can start a little bit better and last a little bit longer. So we appreciate you. Love you, buddy. Thank you so much, everybody. God bless you. Have a great day. Bye-bye.